So first, let me start by thanking the organisers for being able to present. In some ways, it's very, very new work. The title has changed from what we originally had in the program. We were meant to talk originally about linear and nonlinear optics. I'm probably going to be a heretic here and say there is no linear optics. It's only going to be a matter of where you hide your nonlinearity. In linear optics, we bury it in our sources and detectors. And our work, we're going to make slightly more explicit use of it. So probably the key thing here is that my co-workers who worked on this is Kai Nomoto at the National Institute for Informatics in Japan, Tim, Sean, and Peter, who are here in the audience, and Ray Beaujolais from our US labs. This work was funded by Rambo Q and JSPS in Japan. So roughly what we want to do is, you've heard the depressing news about linear optics. And maybe I'll make life a little bit worse before we try and make it slightly better. But, so the first question we've got to ask is, given that linear optics is hard, the gates don't work all the time, should we just give up? Or are there actually advantages to using optics? I mean, the IRC says we need to transmit photons to solid state. So somehow we're going to have to transmit information somehow, and that's likely to be photons. I can't see myself transmitting electrons over free space for hundreds of kilometres. So roughly, I want to keep optics. I want to try and keep some of the advantages of linear optics, but I want to combine linear optics with continuous variables, move the hybrid type of schemes that Martin and co-workers have proposed over the last few years, and say, can we do something useful here? So I don't want to encode the information in the continuous variables, I want to use the continuous variable resources to encode the single photons. So, I mean, just following up the previous talk, I mean, we have, in some ways, the best known bounds for the nonlinear sign shift gate and the control knot gate being a half and a quarter, or the best known, the upper bounds, and what we know as being a quarter or 2/27, or if we take these new results that have just come out, 1/3 and 1/9. 1/9 is a really big number if I want to do 1,000 gates. It's approaches zero very, very rapidly. So in some ways, we've got to move around this. So we know all the tricks. KLM is scalable, but I want to move away from saying I'm going to have to use 100 single photons or 1,000 single photons or 10,000 single photons to do one control knot gate or to encode one piece of information and move it. I want to move to an encoding where one photon, one bit of information. I don't want to have ancilla single photons floating around if I can help it. Or if I do, I really want to keep a strict count on them. Because these things are expensive. Single photon sources and single photon detectors are much more expensive than beam splitters. So in some ways, we don't want to hide things behind our back. We want to bring everything out explicitly. So in some ways, we know we can't improve linear optics just by moving really to cluster states and various things like this. We have some of the near optimal cluster states from the work with Michael Nielsen or Terry Rudolph and Dan Brown at Imperial. But these are still 100 single photons per CNOT gate. If I think of trying to factor 128-bit number, I end up with a lot of photons. I get a headache just trying to actually work out where I'm going to store all these devices, even if I make these devices micron size. I still end up thinking, Imperial's Blackett lab is not big enough.
Yes, it is.
No, it's not. We need a bigger building. So in some ways, we want to address the question, can we add some nonlinearity and how does it help? So when we say, I mean, if only you could give me a cross-curve nonlinearity with a pi phase shift. If you could give me this, I could use the 1988 proposal by Gerard Milburn to just do single photon logic. Done, gone, we go home. We have an industry based on this or a technology based on this. The problem at the moment is that generating this pi phase shift is really, really hard. And in some ways, we don't have solutions for pi. People say, yes, there are ways to scale up to this, but it is really, really challenging when you look at the numbers. The other regime we can move down into is the intrinsic nonlinearities in the Chi-3 materials, which are somewhere around, if this is pi, these intrinsic materials are 10 to the minus 15, 10 to the minus 18.
technically, I can just put 10 to the 18 of these together and build up a pie, but I don't want to do that. So what I want to say is, there's a regime in the middle here. Can I use, if I have some materials at 10 to minus 1, 10 to minus 5, 10 to minus 10, are they any use? And how do I use them? So the first assumption I'm going to make is that I don't have single photon sources and detectors. If I want them, I've got to build them. So I've got to give you a way to actually start creating these things. And the first thing is, I mean, I could start with single photon sources, I could start with single photon detectors. I'm going to start with a single photon detector, going back to a very old idea by Yamamoto and Jared. They did this roughly in the mid-80s, and it's a QND measurement. And, I mean, the QND measurement roughly says that if I have a single photon, or 0, 1, 2 photons coming in, I have a cross-kernel linearity. I have a large coherent state laser, large laser, and I measure the quadratures on it. The particular quadrature measurement that I get here will tell me with pretty high degree what this photon number is. And, I mean, if you look at the size of the kernel linearity you need to do this, it's proportional to the size of the pump. But if you have a pump with, say, a milliwatt pump, then you can get away with cross-kernel linearities of 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 6. So that seems to say you can build a single photon resolving detector if you have a non-linearity that size. No one's done it yet. I mean, this is still a challenge, but only recently have we started moving in this regime where we have, where people have come back to look at weak cross-kernel linearities. EIT has shown this. There's the cross-kernel effects in fibers, microsphere resonators. I mean, there's a whole area of these devices that are somewhere between 10 to minus 8, 10 to minus 1, cavity QED. I mean, which ones we could potentially use in here, we don't know. We're currently going through just saying what's possible, what's not. We don't even know what the optimal schemes are here yet. We do for the detection, this is almost the optimal scheme. I mean, this particular scheme here is photon number. But hey, optics use polarization. So if you want polarization, a polarization QND detector so that it preserves your polarization information. So if you have zero photons, one photon, two photons, but the one photons have polarization information, you just run it through two Kerr crystals where you take your signal in and split it on a polarizing beam splitter. I probably had the beam splitters around the wrong way being a theorist. I take my cross-kernel linearity. Yeah, I try. I interacted on a cross-kernel linearity. Normally, I would just have measured here with my homonymy measurement. I don't measure now. I bring this beam out, and I bring it into a second Kerr crystal, which interacts with the second mode. And then I do the measurement afterwards. Because these have the same phase shift, they induce the same phase shift, this preserves the polarization information. This homonymy measurement then projects you either into 0, 1, 2, whatever photon number you had with the polarization information maintained. So this is very useful for logic. But actually, if I can do that, this becomes very useful. I mean, it goes back to the photon chopping ideas from Dariano. If I take a weak coherent state here, mean photon number 1, forget about the polarization information at the moment, and I pass it through here, when I do the homonymy measurement, if it's a mean photon number 1, I will sometimes measure the homonymy measurement corresponding to a phase shift, which has a phase shift corresponding to one photon. So I can use a weak coherent state with a strong coherent state probe, use the homonymy measurement to project this weak coherent state into a definite photon number state. And actually, it works. If you have the ideal system, it will produce a single photon state 37% of the time. So actually, if you could do this, it's a much more efficient single photon source than what we have now. If you don't want to, if you want two photons, you could just do this twice or three times to build things up, so that if you do it three times, on average, you're going to have one photon when you want on demand. You could use squeeze states for mean photon number 1, and then when it works a quarter of the time, you have two photons. I mean, roughly the size of the nonlinearities we need here is, if alpha is the amplitude of the coherent state, we need alpha times theta, the size of the nonlinearity, approximately 4. So that says roughly choose what theta is, a natural system gives it to you, then see whether you can build your pump to have a large enough coherence, a large enough alpha. So at 10 to the minus 5, you have to have a pump with a mean photon number of 10 to the 10. You don't have to measure that, but that's what has to go through your cross-kernel linearity. Okay, so many people have been worried about the number of photons appearing on the pump, appearing on the detector. Don't worry about that. The restriction we have is how many photons can we pump through the probe mode with that coherent state. That's really the limiting factor, because we know tricks here to optimize these measurements. So given this, I mean, this is a source, this is a detector. I mean, if I only use this, this doesn't help me scale linear logic. I get a second chance, and I can go through and retry failure events, reverse circuits, and I can make gates that were working a quarter of the time, make them work a half of the time, make them deterministic, but I'm bouncing so many bouncing things back and forth so many times, and it's an iterative procedure, it's just not worth it. There's too much feed forward in it. There's too much cost there. So what else can we do? And I mean, there was a very nice idea in terms of one particular gate, a Bell state measurement by Martin in 1999, who showed how, given a cross-kernel linearity, a coherent state, you could actually do a perfect Bell state discrimination. Not an analyzer, but a detector. It would give you a depth of the signature of which Bell state you had. We could just use that idea with Ike Tuong's teleportation idea and build CNOT gates that way. Still use this offline resource. But I don't want to use offline resources. It costs. When I take into account everything, I really want to minimize the cost that I have. So really, in the type of scheme that I want to describe, there will be no hidden nonlinearity. We're not going to hide anything behind the back or say, oh, it's in our detector. We're going to quantify everything as we go along. And the size of the nonlinearity we want are small, but they're still very large compared to natural materials. So the primary gate I want to talk about, it's our fundamental building block for everything, is what we call this 2-qubit parity gate. And roughly consider 2 qubits, polarization encoded. These come through polarizing beam splitters. I have my probe beam. The horizontal polarization, or the top rail, interacts with the cross-kernel linearity. The bottom rail doesn't. On the second qubit, it interacts with the nonlinearity, but this time with a minus theta phase shift. Whether it's plus or minus doesn't matter. We have schemes that if you only have kernel linearity that give you plus theta phase shifts, we can get around that. There isn't a problem. It's just mathematically it's more elegant to have a plus and a minus because you cancel phase shifts out rather than actually rotating your probe beam so much. So actually, if you take this particular statement here, you come through here, say, let's forget about this measurement at the moment. After I've done this interaction, the state that I have, if it was a horizontal and a horizontal photon, it picked up a plus theta phase shift, then a minus theta phase shift. So no phase shift. The V and the V, no phase shift. So I get an HH and a VV, unchanged. If I had a horizontal on this top line and a vertical on the bottom line, it picks up a phase shift, alpha e to the I theta. The other case, VH, picks up an e to the minus I theta. So what we really want to do is just split this subspace in half. So let's consider when the parity measurement is if the polarization is the same, that's even parity. If the polarization is different, that's odd parity. So really what we want to do is a measurement that splits these two in half. And I mean, so I need to be able to distinguish alpha, and I want to do this measurement on the probe field. So I want to distinguish alpha from alpha e to the I theta and alpha e to the minus I theta. I mean, but I don't want to destroy the coherence between these two. Okay? The key is I've got to maintain that coherence. If I do a straight homodyne or a straight heterodyne measurement, I could project into this subspace, but then I'm as likely to actually destroy this subspace. So we need a measurement that actually preserves this polarization, preserves this phase information, just says we can't tell which one. I mean, one that Sean Barrett came up with was an ex-homodyne measurement. That's the simplest. Because if you think of the particular states, you have a coherent state here, alpha, You have alpha e to the I theta here, alpha e to the minus I theta there. Next time that I measurement splits you this way, you can't tell the difference between these two. So it splits your subspace very nicely. That's one way. I mean, I could, but that is a non-optimal measurement, okay? We know of other measurement protocols at the moment where what we can do is actually do pre-processing before we do this, all with linear optics, but we can actually bring this down to nearly a Heisenberg limited measurement. And it's still only using these particular elements, but we're doing pre-processing, conditioning, displacements. We're using the continuous variable toolbox that's been around for a long, long time. So roughly this gate is acting as this parity measurement is acting as an entangling gate. And this is really all we need to do logic with single photons. Because once I have this, consider now that my second qubit is now just an equal superposition H plus V. If I run it through this particular gate, do the projection, yeah, do the classical feed forward that I've got to, depending on what the results of the home line measurement are. There are some phase information that I have to undo because the home line measurement does induce a phase shift that if I ignore, it's a trace operation, I destroy coherence. I've got to make sure the home line measurement is optimal enough to do this. Or if you use some of the other schemes, there's always some information to correct, depending on your result. But roughly, if I start with this particular state, C0H plus C1V in here, and H plus V in here, then by the time I come out of here, I end up with state C0HH plus C1VV. So this gate allows me to create an arbitrary entangled 2-qubit pure state. I mean, I've chosen this at the moment to be HHVV. These are normal polarizing beam splitters, but I can rotate anything before and after that I want, so I can create any state just by local operations. And it's this particular gate that is, in some ways allows us to do a CNOT gate deterministically, or near deterministically. We need to be careful because there are some errors. This homeline measurement is not perfect. What I'm trying to do in here is I say, if I get one result out for the homeline measurement, if I get a result X, which is greater than alpha 1 plus cos theta, you know these quantities, I say, I've bin the data one way. If I get a number that's less than that, I bin it the other way. And the problem that I have is that it's possible to end up with X equals X0. It's possible you're sitting in the region where it's a result that I just don't know which way to. Do I chuck it this way? Do I chuck it this way? But you can make this error for the type of numbers that we're talking about, this alpha C theta approximately 4. The probability of being in this region where you can't attribute the numbers, 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5, other errors are going to kill you before you have to worry about this. So it's a near deterministic gate, but the errors are theoretically much lower than what you're going to see in anything else that's going on. So really, let's come to the critical gate that we need. The critical gate that we need is the CNOT gate. And there'd be many variants of this. This is the one that we think uses the fewest resources. We may be able to drop one or two nonlinearities out, but let's just go through it. I mean, it's a gate that hopefully many of the linear optics people will know that if I replace these entanglers with straight polarizing beam splitters, this is Franson's three-photon CNOT gate. We just took it and said, let's replace this polarizing beam splitters with our entangling operation. Why? Because in Franson's gate, when he just has a polarizing beam splitter in here, his error event is where he has two photons going one way or another. In our particular gate, here, our photons never talk to each other. We have no two-photon effects. Our qubits, our polarization qubits, are really qubits. We're not leaving the Hilbert space. So in here, with my entangling gate, if my control is an arbitrary state, it comes in here, I need one more single photon, I come through another entangler, I'll go through this in a bit more detail soon, but this is now an entangler with 45 degree polarizing beam splitters. Same as Franson has, no tricks, your photon comes out, you do a measurement in either H or V. If it's a Q&D measurement, you don't destroy the photon, you can use it again, potentially. We probably don't want to do that, but it's available. So what it means is if I have n qubits, and I want to do an n-qubit computation for linear optics. We're thinking at the moment if I want 100 qubits to do something, and I start looking at the gates, I think we were up over 10, 20 million single photons required. Because if I want to try and do arbitrary operations and various things, that is just the cost. In this circuit, roughly, I require n plus 1 photons. So to do a 100 photon gate operation, I require 101 photons. If I'm being expensive and I have m qubits, then I'm going to require, and I don't want to recycle this photon, then I'm going to have m plus m single photons, where m's the number of gates. I mean, no one's going to quibble over 1 or m. But if it's 100 and it's 100 CNOT gates or 1,000 CNOT gates, this is scaling significantly better. So let's go through the CNOT gate in a little bit of detail. So my control, my ancilla that's going to come through the center, and my target. So let's, first of all, just look at this left-hand side. Roughly, we've been through this on a previous slide. If this is C0H plus C1V with H plus V, we bring it in, we create the joint state, C0HH plus C1VV. We just want to create an arbitrary pure state. That's easy. I mean, that's just a fundamental gate. Buried in here, we've had some feed-forward operations to do these corrections. We don't have to do these now. We can do these at the end of the circuit. You don't have to correct everything to start with. You've just got to take account of them, and in effect, from what we're seeing at the moment, you don't even have to bother correcting them. You just have to take the tally and do it in your final step in terms of what measurement basis and various things you do, or your particular measurements. So now let's look at the right-hand side, and it's a bit more complicated. But it is, in effect, only the Frampton logic. And that roughly, if you go through the mathematics, and I'm not going to do that here, what you'll find out is that when you do this particular measurement, getting either H or V, if you get a V, you've got a bit flip to your sigma x operation to do a bit flip. Your state that you get out is this. And what we notice is that roughly what we've done is we've, as a controlled, it's a CNOT gate because this was an H, it's now a V. This was a V, it's now an H. That's CNOT logic. If you want to do a control phase shift with a minus sign rather than a CNOT gate, all these type of variants are very, very easy. I mean, what I've done in this particular gate so far is I've had one ancilla photon, okay? So let me just flip back. So here I had one photon. What I could do, potentially, is start with two photons in an EPR state. Spread these to different spatial locations. Okay, so have an EPR up here, share between two distant places, and this then allows me to do a CNOT gate between qubits in different places. Our single photons never talk to each other. Once I've established a link, one EPR up here, one Bell state between these two sites, I can then do CNOT gates between photons on this side and photons on this side. So the scheme that we're proposing here is really a distributed computation scheme. You can do it locally if you want. You can do it distributed if you want. It makes no difference. If you want to do it distributed, you just change this slightly because you don't want to send the single photon over a channel. Single photons down fibers are fragile. Coherent states are still fragile because we're not sending a straight coherent state. We're sending a slightly non-Gaussian state, but it's quite resilient to loss. So the first thing that our type of gates have shown us is that we can push the probability of success to near unity. We don't worry about the home line measurement efficiencies or various things and errors from assigning which bin. Experimental errors are going to overtake that anyway. So we call it near deterministic. Deterministic, it makes no difference. This gate potentially works 99.999% of the time, ideally. If you take real efficiencies into account and type of materials that people have today, this gate probably could work around 95%. And this just comes down to take mode matching and all the type of realistic effects, pulse shapes, and it just degrades things. If you can improve that slightly, then this gate becomes significantly you can improve this the efficiency. How big a non-linearity do you want? I mean, the type of scheme that I've presented here today, we're saying 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5. We have schemes now that will take us 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 7. All we do is we just keep changing the home run measurements. We do pre-processing information, and we use the standard state discrimination techniques that people have been looking at in continuous variables for a long time, and we implement those using weak kernel linearities. This seems to be an advantage. So really, we're nearly there, but not quite. So really what we're saying is, don't worry about generating a pi phase shift. If you're looking at nonlinear materials, somewhere between this 10 to the minus 1, 10 to the minus 7 is probably good enough. Pi is a waste. You're working too hard. Move down a little bit. And what we've seen at the moment is that, I mean, really the distributed nature of this is potentially a very, very large advantage. There are a few other applications of this. I mean, I've already mentioned Martin has a Bell state detector. There's a nice paper by Sean Barrett recently with Peter Koch and us at HP showing how to build a symmetry analyzer or Bell state analyzer. Not a detector, an analyzer. We do not destroy the Bell states. You project onto one of the four Bell states, or you project onto one of the maximum entangled states. There's certain applications where this is actually quite an advantage. So really, I mean, the advantage of these weak kernel linearities, you have your sources, you have your detectors, you can start generating, we've talked about single photons here, but you can generate cat states. If you want Schrodinger cat states of reasonable, of small intensity, this is much more efficient than most of the work in the literature. You can generate high noon or oh no states, however you want to do this, for metrology applications. It just seems to be a very fruitful area. If you can give me a little bit of nonlinearity experimentally, we can do a lot with it. We want to leave the experimental ground of just straight linear optics. So really just a summary saying that I'll give a slightly different message on. To do single photon quantum computation, what resources do I need? I need linear elements. I need beam splitters, phase shifters, laser beams, Hohmann measurements, all linear elements. And then I need a weak kernel linearity. I need nothing else. I haven't talked about needing single photon sources. I will produce those if I need them. If I want single photon detectors, I will produce those. But really the core new universal set just says that you need this weak nonlinearity. It may be more efficient to use single photon sources or single photon number resolving detectors, but they are not a prerequisite for single photon quantum computation. Really, it comes back to an old message by Martin and Sam Bronstein, saying if you want to do quantum computation, the continuous variable set is all you need with the nonlinearity. Once you have some form of nonlinearity, the single photons are just a subset of this. Continuous variables trumps single photons. So let's use the advantages that the continuous variable world give us in the single photon world. I think that's it.
Yeah, maybe I did not completely understand your Q&D idea with the cross-kernel linearity.
Yeah.
Two things. If you have a readout pulse which has, say, 10 to the 14 photon,
yep,
and you have a Poissonian noise of 10 to the 7 typically,
yep,
and that adds, of course, a huge phase uncertainty.
Onto a single photon, it doesn't. The whole point is you're thinking of the normal back action that you see from QND measurements, but when you only have a single photon, what happens is that there's a window. The phase uncertainty actually is sitting on the coherence. I mean, you can view all the phase uncertainty as sitting in the coherent state and none on the single photon. If it's a realistic pulse, there is some back action onto the single photon pulse, but you can minimize those type of effects because roughly what you're looking at is different Gaussians sitting at different places in your phase space.
But I'm not worried about the phase uncertainty.
Yeah.
But just if you want to read out the phase of the readout pulse,
yeah,
and say whether there's,
yeah,
a problem or not, you have a huge noise on the phase.
Yeah. Yeah, but if the pulses are, if the different coherent states are well enough separated, so alpha e to the I theta, if the overlap between those pulses, even taking into account the photon number distribution, if one is here and one is here, and the overlap between them is small, so as long as you create a large enough phase shift, you can minimize this Poissonian distribution from having any effect.
Surface modulation has always,
yes,
at least the same strength like cross-phase modulation.
Yeah.
May be able to clear this. You're thinking of, the person behind us, thinking of fibers where effectively it's not a narrow band non-linearity.
Yeah.
What you're thinking is there's no non-linearity for the probe, which could be a watt, be 10 watts. But there is a non-linearity associated with the single photon. So
yes,
that's something like EIT, maybe, where your probe is...
EIT, cavity QED have seen similar effects. Some of the microsphere resonators are showing these things.
Good. So I suppose, what to rephrase the question, could you think of a scheme whereby if we could come up with a very non-linear fiber,
yes,
how could you... Because remember that the probe then will also have its own,
yep,
non-linearity associated with,
yep,
it.
And roughly, even, I mean, we've looked at some cases where the probes have some self-curve modulation. And roughly it comes down to then just seeing, working out, is there enough discrimination to actually be able to project the measurements? I mean, and there are effects like squeezing and that help. So that what you do is, because you know the self-modulation works along one particular direction, it normally takes your coherent state and slaps it this way, you use squeezing to bring it back to an extent. So you use these type of continuous variable tricks to really help. These are hard, but...
This is sort of a hunch rather than something I'm fully sure of, but it seems to me you're putting a powerful laser beam into your medium along,
yep,
with your weaker beam. I'm guessing that the reason you've got the ability to do the things you've described is something to do with the fact that you interfere a big thing with a small thing.
Yep.
Interference somehow gets amplified.
Yes, there's an exponential amplification.
But a very simple reaction to that is you're somehow on the side of a very steeply varying curve. So at the same time, you're very much more sensitive to the relative phase of these two beams. And it seems to me that you need to be sure you've looked into that as an experimental issue before your experimental friends will sort of grab hold of this,
yeah,
idea. So,
for two systems at the moment, for EIT and the microsphere resonators, where we've actually done the detailed calculations, these things look pretty robust. So that the particular errors that we're seeing, because we characterise most of the things beforehand, because we know roughly what the strength of the of the laser is and what its fluctuations are, we know with the EIT system or the microsphere resonators roughly what size non-linearities they're inducing on average and what their distribution is, then we can calibrate the system to actually just allow the best discrimination. I mean, these are tough experiments. I mean, there's a reason no one has done them yet. And the reason is that the first hurdle is high. The first hurdle is you've got to do a Q&D measurement. And that has not been done. But if you can do that, then these open up. There are two groups at the moment that are looking at this.
Bill, you mentioned just a moment ago, you mentioned microsphere. Is that the whispering Gallimimo microsphere with an atom in it, or what is that?
Some of them are with atoms and some of them are without.
Well, then how do you get the nonlinearity?
Because some of the spheres themselves are showing nonlinear effects.
Due to what?
Just due to the particular material.
What's a good material?
At the moment, some of the glass effects.
Some of the what?
Just glass.
What kind of glass?
I'm not... Yeah.
Just, well, it's, who did that experimentally?
That's been done by Takeuchi.
Oh.
Japan. So they're showing...
This is like... what is this? Is this two photons interacting with the microsphere?
So at the moment they have not done the two photons. They're looking at one photon interacting with the sphere doing self-homodyne effectively.
Oh. Uh-huh.
And they're seeing small nonlinear effects.
Oh.
whether they're big enough. I mean, that's why I'm saying the particular bound of nonlinearity that we need here depends on the materials. I mean, eventually I think you'll put atoms into these things, or you'll use NV diamond or various things like this. I mean, any system which gives you just enough nonlinearity, you actually don't want too much, because you want to preserve your pole shapes going through these things. So the smaller the nonlinearity you can get away with, the better off you are.
In Kimball scheme, one atom is enough.
Yep. Yes.
When the probe comes through and interacts, if it's interacting with the superposition state, is the probe put into some kind of a cat state?
Yep.
And if so, do you have to worry about decoherence of the cat state?
Yes.
Which would increase with the number of photons.
Actually, the decoherence doesn't increase with the number of photons, because what happens is it's a cat state, but it's a very small cat state. So it's a coherent state here and a coherent state here. So the distance between these things are very small. So the distance between these is about 3 or 4. So you could, if you do a large phase shift, you'd generate a full cat state, but you don't want to do that because it's so fragile. So you really just want to take the smallest amount of phase shift that you can to generate a cat type of state.
Okay.
So, I mean, we modelled some of the stuff with some of the standard loss in the channels, and what we found out was that you can chuck away 10-15% of the noise in the channel with absorption or beam splitters or various things, and you still maintain very high fidelities of those N2 states. The parity measurement, or the projection into the subspaces, is actually pretty good.
In the end, what still hurts is, of course, classical feed forwards and changing that with latent times.
Yeah.
And it would be nice, of course, if one could just recalculate everything at the end on a classical computer and not having to do it physically.
So for lots of this, we can.
Because, you know, is that true that for...
Not for all of it, but for some of it, we can. So there are a whole lot... There end up being about 4 feed forward operations that you need to do. 3 of them, I believe, you can remove. 3 of them are just a matter of how you attribute 0 and 1 at the end of the calculation. One of them, you can't. One of them, we haven't been able to find out how to correct. But the mean phase shift that you actually have to do the correction on is 0.
Does it depend on the gate you do? Like in the Hans computer, where you can, in the Clipper type part, you could just forget about any changes of phase and do it in the end on a classic computer? Does that depend on the gate that you use? Or?
In this particular case, we found out with the feed forward that at the end, what we're roughly doing is flipping H to V, V to H before we did our particular measurement. So that's just a matter of having a tally at the end and saying, oh, sorry, we flipped our qubit, so we know this relabel. But there are 1 or 2 cases.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yep.